This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
To me, when my wife left me, I realized that comedy is noble. People are hurting, and it's good. It's good. It's like a good thing to do. Think about an audience. If you afterwards think about the individuals, the heartbreaks that are in the audience. Some of them are being cheated on. Some of them just got sober. You know what I mean? Some of them, they just lost a parent.
Too bad there's a two-drink minimum in most clubs. They just got sober.
Two-item. It's a two-item minimum here at Stand Up New York. And you really are, and I don't use this in a religious way, you're ministering to them. You're ministering in the way that someone bringing chicken soup is ministering to a sick person. So you can really relieve that tension. So what are you going to do with it? Are you going to talk about piddly shit? Or are you going to go deep? Most stand-up I see is just reaffirming what the crowd already knows. But I can't stand it. People just go, isn't sex great? Isn't eating great? Aren't movies great? And they're just holding the mirror up and they're just going like, leave the same. And something happens when you're in pain. You realize that you have an opportunity to like really rearrange the molecular structure of a lot of people in a positive way. I know I'm being a little bit high-hoped about stand-up, but good comedy can fucking change this because you saw somebody on stage that knows how to alchemize pain into pleasure. And I'm getting emotional, but that's fucking beautiful. We were just, Kate and I were just talking about that. She mentioned some show that's on Netflix that I wanted to watch, and I forgot about it because it mentioned it to me once, and then it just goes away, and then all I see is like Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm like, why? It needs like an AI. It needs like a, hello, Peter.
But they
something
they
that talks
do,
to
like,
me.
Guess what the two most popular shows on Netflix are.
I'm going to guess. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Because I think they're old shows, right? I think the most... Friends? These are my... Don't look at me. Don't give me information with your face.
I play poker. I'm not...
Okay, yeah, give me nothing. Friends and... Oh, it's going to be obvious. It's sure as shit not Stranger Things or anything like that. It's Friends and Mad Men. Those are my guesses.
Friends and The Office.
I was so close.
And the original
shows...
You
do have a good poker face. Either that or you have no joy when other people win.
A little bit of both. Everybody says House of Cards and Stranger Things.
But yeah, those, no way.
All the original programming dying on Netflix.
Of course.
And you know, Hulu... like
Not I, of course. It's a surprise to me, too, but I had heard that. They can't get people to watch new stuff. The thing I watch is old stuff.
Yeah.
Val's always watching Friends. And, you know, narcissistically, I'm always watching Mad Men. That's why those were my guesses.
I'm always watching on Amazon this little show on HBO called Crashing.
And O-M-G.
It's like my wife gets sick of it.
Does she?
No.
That's
no.
Hilarious. No, it's
we
okay.
It together.
It's okay, but, it, you know, enough is enough. Mad Men is for me, so my poor wife has to watch. I told myself I wouldn't watch it again.
I've watched the series twice.
Crashing.
Mad Men.
I've seen
Crashing four times.
That's so sweet.
So, Mad Men's too long. I'm gearing up for a third time.
I think I've watched Mad Men at least six times.
Are we rolling? Yep. All right. Well, have you rewatched any other series? Like I've watched Lost about four times.
No way. The whole thing.
Because I actually like the series finale.
Okay. Even though they've like sort of, I know this is not news to you, that they like admitted that they didn't know what they were doing. And
well, yeah, you could tell in the writing that they keep on opening up more and more forks in the plot.
Yeah.
And they'd have you could tell they have no clue how they're going to bring
right.
it together.
That's
but
right.
I was fine with, it's fine not knowing
yeah.
the end.
What is the end? They're in purgatory?
No, the end is that...
I don't want to ruin it. Yeah. It's a show from 1992. I don't want to ruin it.
The end is half the show is sort of like a dream sequence, but you know, in this final season, and half is, you know, Jack becomes the new Jacob. Anyway.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, and then Hurley becomes the new Jacob. And then they have an epilogue that most people didn't see kind of after the... It was like a new show. Anyway.
Can I tell you something, James?
Yes.
What I like about Lost, even if I didn't stick with it the whole way, I like what you just said, But what you, like, even in the first early seasons, and this is like a very spiritual idea, and I'm not trying to force that because we're going to, I really am not.
No, but I but it's like
about,
this.
It's because, about us versus other, right?
Yeah.
It's about this idea that we're on the island and then there are the others. And then you realize that the others have their story and that every other is just another group. You know, this is like a lot of good movies help us tell this
And
story.
Then there's this component that the island is this mystery that we can't possibly understand.
Yeah, I like
we
that.
We never too. Understand it.
Yeah.
But you just have to have faith in it. And that's the people right. who do have faith in it survive.
Oh, is that right?
So,
you know, I had Dr. Drew on my podcast. He's not a spiritual person at all, but he's been with a lot of dying people. And this is actually kind of chilling to me. This is not why I'm spiritual, by the way, although maybe it is. Maybe it is. He was telling me that people that believe in something when they're dying, he's like, they have a much easier time. I was like, that's fucking nuts. Like, he has data on it. It's chilling. I don't like it. I mean, what I don't like about it is I want it to be like more than just something we comfort ourselves with, but it turns out there is this like comforting element for sure.
But
I did it on the cab ride over. I was like, it's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah, because I can,
not because I'm going to heaven. I'm just like, it's all whatever's like the island. Whatever's happening is happening. And you
right.
just have to surrender, which is the name of the chapter you folded over for me in that book. It's called Surrender.
Right. Like, you don't, I like what Dr. Drew is saying because it's not necessarily you have to believe in one specific thing, like a heaven.
Yeah.
It's, that you believe, you know, like in the island, we don't know the answers. We just know there's
right
mystery.
That's right.
So it's a surrender to mystery.
And there's a, I see, especially in nature, obviously human beings are fucked. But when I look at nature, which is something that speaks to me about the lawfulness of the universe, I tend to see something that is positive, that's leaning towards growth and expansion rather than just like meaningless nothingness.
Do you think, I mean, obviously, I mean, so your book, which we're talking about, is called, I should introduce you.
Yeah, it's
Pete
fine.
Holmes, star of the
They've
HBO
already
show.
Turned it off. It's over.
Well,
Kareem.
People listen.
I got Kareemed.
People listen on their commute, so they're still commuting. We're talking to Pete Holmes, star of HBO show Crashing, star of the Pete Holmes show, which you could find all over the place. The podcast, your podcast, You Made It Weird.
Yeah.
You've been involved in so many different
this
shows.
This is off the dome, James. Hmm? Usually someone's scrolling through a Wikipedia page when they do
no,
that.
No, I'm a fan and I
know,
watch
I
a lot of
that,
your YouTube. I encourage people to actually watch your YouTube set with Conan, which triggered Conan asking you to do
your
show. It was a very good set.
Yeah, but that's really good thinking on you. That's like three-dimensional thinking. You're not just like, you're like, which set was it? Because there was a set. There was a set.
Yeah.
And you can watch it. It's Pete Holmes' magic.
Well, you know what? It's
called magic. I didn't just name the clip. Pete Holmes, magic. He's magic in this clip.
I think also, though, it's like you even mentioned in the book, it kind of, you sort of evolved. We'll talk about a whole bunch of things, but in this, you sort of evolved from kind of observational humor to observational humor that really meant something to you.
That's right.
And I think that was a big change in your personal voice.
Yeah.
Because I think you always had this outlook where you want to be friends with the audience. You want the audience to like you. You want to be friends with them. You're smiling with them, and right. you're taking them along for a ride. But then I think at some point it must have occurred to you, oh, I'm going to take them along for a better ride if it's something that's really unique and personally interesting to me that's buried in the joke somewhere.
I completely, yeah, that's right. That's very nice of you to say. But, I had a manager when I was in New York in the real life that we that we dramatized on Crashing. When I was really living that here in the city, I had a meeting with Rick Dorfman, who is a manager, I believe. He certainly was at the time. And he was John Mulaney's manager, and I think John got me a meeting with him or something. And I was really excited that I was going to get a manager. I mean, we have some young comics here today. I don't know if you guys are repped. It seems like everybody's repped. But back in the day, it was like hard to get reps. And I really wanted a manager, and I thought that was going to like crack things open for me. And I was basically just starting out. And he did not sign me. And he did something really gracious, though. I was visiting my parents in Boston. I went into my parents' bedroom to get privacy, and I sat in my mom's rocking chair. And he was like,
I like these like kind of intimate details, like your mom's rocking chair.
Well, you know, James, we're painting a picture. Right. It's helping me, honestly. It's helping me remember. I want to be honest with you. And I was sitting there with my iPhone 3. I'm just kidding. That's a joke. And he did something really gracious. And I've thanked Rick many times, and we've talked about it since then. Because a lot of people won't sign you, but he told me why he wasn't signing me. And he was like, and we put some of these words into Esty's mouth on Crashing. She's like, I just don't know what you care about. He's like, what makes you angry? What makes you scared? He's like, you're just another white guy. And this is, I know that's like kind of a hot thing right now, right, is that we're understanding privilege. This is way before that. He was just like, you're just another, he might as well have said, you're just another fucking guy.
I remember the scene where Esty is saying this to you, and I've taken that quote and applied it to so many things, because you could apply that same, and I'll say the quote that Esty says in a second. You can apply it to comedy, of course. You could apply it to any kind of writing, because you could apply it to entrepreneurship even. But her quote is, who are you? Why are you? Why now?
Yeah.
And I think that was so important. Like, so many people just like, you know, dribble out their Facebook comments, right, from their suburban air-conditioned homes, right, like their diplomas on the wall, and they go, oh no, you're wrong about climate change, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And no one is saying, why should they be saying this? Right. Why now? Why, you know, who are they why are they saying this? Like, why, right, is this conversation happening? And Facebook makes money on all the anger.
That's right. And fires get all the traffic. You, right, start a little fire and it gets the algorithm. And this is why my friend Rob Bell is like, that's why we have Trump. Like, we're a fire-seeking society. And that kind of started with social media. That's his theory, not mine. It's very interesting.
Right. We're a fire-seeking society. And I think the questions, you know, who are you, why are you, why now, starts to bring the fire a little to you.
That's
you,
right,
become the fire.
Why are you doing the bit? And having, I know this sounds a little bit Tony Robbins, but there's something about having an intention. For me, when I do stand up, my intention is literally, it's very cheesy, and I'm a little embarrassed to say this in front of my family, my species, but it's like, I want everyone to feel less alone. I want them to feel, obviously we want them to feel happy and joy, that's fine, but like, I'd like them to feel like, oh, I'm not the only weirdo. So I want to expose some sort of bullshit in myself or in the world that we all have, that they can go like, oh, I do that too. But what happened with that Conan set was, I was like, everybody is, now when I think I have an idea for a bit, it's because something excites me, right? And this is left brain, right brain stuff. I used to be reciting jokes, that's right brain. You're doing something that you memorized. There's nothing wrong with memorizing, but I'd go up there, and I still do it sometimes. I go like, did you know the movie Three Amigos was released in Spanish-speaking countries as Tres Friends? That's a joke that I recite. And that's fine. I like that joke.
Right, so that's a funny joke. Like, we're doing this podcast inside a comedy club. That's the sort of joke that's safe.
That's
a comedy,
right,
club audience will laugh.
And when you're starting out, I almost said brother, Hulk Hogan, you need those jokes. People don't care. You're one of 15 and you need something that goes like, let me demonstrate that I can write a joke.
Right, and you're also trying, you don't want to disappoint the booker, you don't
That's
want to
right.
disappoint the
oh
club.
Oh my God, what I'm talking about is 10 years plus, mm-hmm. Maybe. And you start getting into something where you're like, you're just talking to your partner or your friends and you realize that you really care about something and that you don't need to script it out exactly. You have the bullet points and maybe some of the key phrases written out verbatim, but it's something that you know that you can just communicate. So the bit was, everybody hates magic because it's fake. And I'm like, yeah, it's fake. The person's trying to delight you. Don't be an asshole. That was the joke. That was like something I really cared about. So it was something silly, but like, I think Conan even specifically said to me at one point, he was sort of like, every comedian, you give 100 comedians the subject magic, 100 of them are going to write a joke about how magic is stupid. You know what I mean? And I was like, well, how can I be true to myself? I wasn't trying to be unique, but it turned out that I ended up doing something unique by doing a bit that was like in defense of magic.
Do you ever see the movie The Prestige?
Yeah.
So I like, The Prestige was a word that was made up for that movie, but
ruined The Prestige.
I like the idea of The Prestige, which is that there's the trick, and then when everyone is trying to figure out the trick or is shocked, then there's the other trick, then there's the next trick, which kind of caps off the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I feel comedy does that as well, where you sort of have, let's say you have a following premise, then there's a punchline, and then suddenly there's like that extra tag or punchline
sure.
that
or
takes it in a complete different direction.
You pull it into focus. So The Prestige is, for people that aren't familiar with the somewhat niche Christopher Nolan movie, The Prestige.
Oh, not everyone has seen.
I know we all
niche
watched
Christopher
it this
Nolan
morning.
Movies.
If you have a birdcage with a bird in it, and he squashes it with a silk over it, and then that's the trick, is that he made the whole thing disappear. The Prestige is making the bird come back, right? So to me, there is a comedy prestige, and it's often missing, especially if you're going to go like really dark or something. I have a joke about how life is like a piece of pizza because we're all just trapped in this thing where we're just feeding our meat puppets and like the first bite is salty cheesy and your brain lights up and you're like, oh, salty cheesy, and you're so happy. And then the second bite, it's salty cheesy and you're still so happy, but a little bit less happy, but still pretty happy. And then the third, fourth, five, I do four, four bites, you're still pretty happy, but you're ready for something new. And then there's the crust and you're like, oh, bready, 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 bready. And then you eat three bites of bready, bready. And then when you're done with the bready bready, you're like, you know what would be good? Some salty cheesy. And that's why you have the next piece if you're a monster like me. So that might be like the joke, but then like finding some way to land it. Like you can't, what I do, I don't want to just go like, and life is a meaningless cycle of fulfilling needs. I want to take it to a place of like, or, and this is what I do with the audience, we can concede that this is enough right now. And it's just a game that you play with your brain. And it's a trippy thing to get 300 people to just go like, let's just pretend it's okay for 1 second. Because most people, even when they're watching a comedy show, they're like, okay, when are we gonna leave? We're gonna get, like, we gotta get the train, we gotta get home. Then what are we gonna watch? And what am I gonna eat when I'm watching it? I'm gonna have ice cream. Oh, then I want some water. When am I gonna go to bed? How much, you ever do sleep math? How much sleep am I gonna get? I'm gonna get up at this time.
Every day.
That's everybody. And one of the points of the book is there's something about just going like surrendering and just going, this is enough. I'm doing it right now.
Right,
it makes you happier.
So in comedy, sex, God, you have these, it's basically the story of your life, but in these interweaving themes of like your search for meaning through religion. You started off as super serious Christian as a kid, and how that evolved, and then you go on this kind of transformational spiritual journey as you look for meaning, and then of course wrapped up in your religious feelings is your attitudes of originally guilt and shame about sex and how that evolves. And then, of course, interweaving across this is comedy and your comedy career.
Right.
And a lot of the comedy stems from this sort of, you correct me if I'm wrong, stems from this, the differences between your actual needs and what's in your life. And in the middle, there is the comedy. So your needs are, I want to have spiritual meaning, but what's happening in your life is, but Christian, and I'm this, and I'm this, and there's this difference, there's this gap that you have to bridge, and a lot of your humor is about bridging these gaps. Like sex, you're obviously, ashamed of pornography, and you can't have sex,
and that's
until
why
marriage.
All the jokes about pornography, still to this day,
right? Because you're exploring that this gap that
still
you live
don't
with.
Feel great about it. And
that's just it. Is I think everybody in life, your point really is everybody in life has. Gaps, right?
We have that's absolutely right.
These things that we
need. And comedy should hopefully be the one place where you can explore those things. Because you have who you're, that's a very Mad Men thing. It's who the world tells you need to be and who you really are. And what's great about advertising is always telling you like, it's okay to be who you really are. Eat a pizza.
Right, but advertising is also telling you if you drink Coke Zero, suddenly you're
going to
have a great
wrong.
Car and lots of sex.
Don't get me wrong. It's a fucking lie. My hotel was, I just checked out, but it was on Fifth Avenue. So I was walking up and down and seeing how images and bullshit is sold to us. And we love that. We love thinking if I wear a shirt that says Under Armour that I'm strong somehow, which is fucking nonsense.
I don't have to, if I buy a Lululemon jacket, that I worked out that day. That's my workout for the day.
Oh, you just helped me realize I sometimes rock a Lulu, and it's to look like maybe I'm either about to work out or I did this morning.
Yeah, I already worked out.
Neither is
Once you look like it,
the
you
sweat
did it.
Is because I ate very vigorously.
Right. Yeah.
So don't get me wrong, but I think there's a more substantial place to get a inherent, naturally occurring feeling of inherent dignity and worthiness that isn't something that you need to buy. And that for me is a connection with what I call, what you can call isness or thisness, just like your being a part of the lawful unfolding of reality is a quiet place where you can derive. I'll give the comedians an example. I have a hard time with this. I think we all do, getting our value from other people. And as a, you know, spiritual, none of us like these words, but as a spiritual person, I'm trying to do what I'm telling you. I'm trying to let my participation with isness be enough to give me a general gleam of bliss and hope and joy in my day, right? But I'm susceptible just like everybody. So I went to dinner with a friend. This is like literally 2-3 nights ago. And he brought a friend. So there was a friend of a friend and my friend. And the friend of the friend just didn't seem very happy that I was at this dinner. I don't know why. They were just kind of being cold to me. And I was like, okay. I kept trying to like involve them. And it just wasn't really working. Then we went to a show. And I did very well. And after the show, the friend of the friend was very interested in me. Suddenly had, I don't mean sexually. I just mean suddenly this person had a lot of questions. And was like, oh my God, how did you do that? When did you write that bit? I love that bit. And I caught myself feeling that high. I was like, you're goddamn right. Like my ego gets the wheel for a second. And I'm like, that's who you were having dinner with. You know what I mean? I'm a special golden boy. And I just proved it. I rang the bell and I spiked the ball and it felt good. But the spiritual part or whatever, that's all fine, by the way. There's no shame here. I was just like, shit, I'm stuck in salty cheesy again. I just had a bite of salty cheesy and I was like, oh, life is good. And I want a happiness that's not contingent on people, friends of friends, liking me. But there I was believing the hype, right?
Well, because there's one thing you control and there's one thing you can't control. The one thing you can't control is you're human. So humans have dopamine and neurochemicals and,
sure.
and backgrounds that you can't just erase. And so when people hit certain buttons, people,
totally.
These neurochemicals are
And by
triggered.
The way, this is because I come from the Christian tradition, this is not me feeling shame about how I felt. I was just noticing. I was like, oh, interesting. I'm feeling so much happier and powerful. And I don't want my happiness or my power to be derived in the opinion of a friend of a friend. But here's the next part. The next day, somebody on Instagram was like, hey, this person's tweeting something nasty about you. Why I looked it up, I'll never know. Why did I do that? What is that? Because I'm still feeling good from my show the night before, so maybe I'm looking for some salty with my sweet. I don't know. So I Google it. I look it up. I look at it, you know, I search it on Twitter, and I read it. And then I'm shocked that good feeling of worthiness and happiness goes away because I read just as equally a stranger as the friend of the friend, but just some person that's saying, like, I stink, right? And I'm talking to my wife, Val, about this, and I'm just like, what is going on? I want to be outside of this, but here I am stuck in it again. And she was like, well, you went to that show, and you won over the friend of the friend, and you believed your hype. And then it's almost like the universe, let's just say reality, throws you this converse example, the other side of it. Just as simply a tweet takes you into the down. And this is why we wanted to opt out of the game. So that suffering that I was feeling, and it was real from the tweets, it was a bunch of them. When I was resisting them, it caused a lot of pain for me. And when I saw them as a teacher, as something that said, as Maya Angelou said, don't pick it up, don't lay it down. You can't believe the hype and you can't believe the nastiness either. You have to sort of be outside of it.
And you refer to this in the... Sorry to interrupt.
That's fine.
I'm a interrupter.
Me too.
You refer to this in the book in a couple of different ways. One is you say you aspire to be a witness, right? You use the word witness to what is going on.
Right.
So you feeling angry is not necessarily a bad thing once you start witnessing it. Because then, then you separate it. Then there's nothing to judge because it's sort of like outside of, it's separate from the witness.
Well, this is an important thing, I think, for anybody. It doesn't matter if you're an atheist or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Christian. It does not matter. You can practice identifying with what I call the witness, what some spiritual traditions call your soul. But whatever it is, it's your base awareness. So you were born and you were just awareness. This happened. And then people told you who you were. People told you you were a girl. People told you you were American. You were from Connecticut. People told you that you were a whatever baseball team, Red Sox. I don't know what Connecticut likes. But you inherited all this identity, right?
Steve, what is Connecticut like?
Connecticut's both Yankees and Red Sox.
Well, I went. Depends on part of Connecticut. I went with the underdogs, right? They're the underdogs? I don't even know. Who fucking cares? But what I'm saying is none of that is inherently you. It's what Jung calls the false self. We're building up this identity. What I'm saying is a lot of spiritual traditions can offer you a way, a method to identify with the true self or the soul, which is base, neutral, spacious, free awareness that is just observing. So in that situation, I was going, wow, Pete's really upset about this.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that, this is a big thing. In Christianity, I used to pray for peace. We used to wish it upon each other. We'd go, peace be with you. Doesn't work. This is Ram Dass. Peace cannot exist in the ego. That's the story. That's your false self. That's who you are,
right.
Where you're going, what's owed you, who gave you respect, who didn't. There's no peace there. Maybe for a second when you're eating the salty cheesy, you go like, life is good. And then you want a cup of water. You know what I mean? There's no peace there. Peace comes in, I'm going to stand back here and look at all of that happening.
Right, so it's the difference between the Pete that was a Christian compared with the witness who is observing this Pete with Christian values and maybe evolving into different values and so on.
That's right. Because look at how much he's changed. What was consistent? Right. A lot of spiritual teachers will say that even your beliefs, even your ideologies, I say in the book, I might disagree with myself in 3 years and that's okay. This is a process for everybody. But we want to, it's all ego. We want to know what clan we belong to, what tribe we belong to. I say like really going like, these are my beliefs. I'm a Lutheran, I'm a predetermined, I'm a Calvinist or whatever. That's all just like a Patriots jersey. It's just like a group you belong to. And that feels good to your brain. But we're talking about heart stuff, not head stuff. So like even your beliefs, and I'm using a lot of spiritual people use this comparison. You're the sky. You're the constant. And the beliefs and the feelings and the sensation and the story are just clouds. Because even in the book, which Pete was I, really? You know what I mean? Was I baby Pete? Was I married Pete? Was I evangelical Pete? It's all just sort of, we could call it bullshit and be funny, or we could just be like, it's just what's happening. It's just what's unfolding.
Well, you mentioned in the book, I thought, an interesting metaphor, which is that... you know, you can view things as a curriculum. Yeah. So life is a curriculum and you're just having these experiences where this, you know, inner self, whatever you want to call it, is learning from this curriculum, and that's the whole purpose. So somebody tweeting, you know, Pete sucks is just another lesson on this curriculum.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's why
that's a hard stance to always take. If someone...
I agree.
I mean, everybody here gets trashed all the time everywhere.
I know.
And it's
sometimes
hard.
In real time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But every day it happens. Every day I catch myself at least once pulling up a response window.
Yeah, I catch myself. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Who's the I and who's the myself? You know what I mean? That's like sort of the beginning. I know you know that stuff. I'm not blowing your mind right now, but there's something watching you going like, oh, James is getting really worked up. James is opening the window. You know what I mean? And then I can't deal with myself anymore. So you stop yourself. So something stops yourself. It's interesting.
So there was another, there's so many, let me see which direction we're going to go here. Well, comedy, this seemed like you started around 2000, right?
Yeah, that's about right. Yep.
So there must have been some, these internal conflicts are happening, you know, religion, you know, sex, your marriage, everything. What drove you to stand-up comedy? Was it a way to somehow voice this disconnect you were feeling?
I think so. I mean, like, I touch upon it a little bit in the book, was that, like, I just didn't feel super heard in my family. You know what I mean? I mean, they listened to me, but like I sort of had to be big and funny to get their attention. So that's, I still have to. Like when I hang out with my parents, I have to do an impression of them to them to get them to listen. Like my dad is talking, I'll go, "Oh, what?" Like he's always like, "What was it like working with Jeff Applebaum?" He means Judd Apatow, and I'll just go like, "Well, Jeff Applebaum, what was that like, Peter? Was he a good worker?" And then he laughs, and then I'm, because what he's doing when he says Jeff Applebaum and what was that like is it actually, it can hurt my feelings. As I'm, as you, I'm sure the comics can relate, is you're like, "How big do you have to get before daddy will pick me up?" You know what I mean? And he's like, "Was that a big deal?" He once went, "On a scale from 1 to 10, Peter, how big of a deal is it to have a show on HBO? And instead of going, "Meh, I thought this would work. You know, I thought you would see me." I just go, you know, I just do him back to him and make him laugh. Because there's no point in going like, "Dad, in a safe space, I'd like to say that that makes me feel a little bit unseen right now." He's gone. He's looking at a butterfly that's flying by. You saw him on the show. He's 10 times as, if that's bad, then he's 10 times worse. If he's good, he's 10 times better.
Wait, the guy who played your dad on the show, that wasn't your real dad?
No, no. He looks like him. No.
Okay.
Yeah. Except he's much shorter than my dad.
Your mom, who at different points in the show,
yeah,
I'm not saying your real mom, your character's mom in the show Crashing, she makes a great comment when you perform at the Grizzly Pear. She makes the great point that he was telling the truth and you weren't.
Yeah. So James is talking about there's a set where my parents come and watch me at this club, and I do clean comedy, and Jason does very, very dirty comedy. And then my mom, in this twist, who's religious, thought Jason was better because he had something to say.
Even though he was so crude,
yeah,
it was against all of their values. They made kind of a deeper connection to what's comedy,
right? And at least he was saying something. It goes back to what Rick Dorfman said to me. He was like, at least we sort of knew what he was struggling with. But I will say that is a Judd twist. That the first draft of the script was, my mom was like, what it would have been in real life was, "I'm so proud of you for being clean. Thank you for being a light in this club." That's what she would have said. And she would have said, "That guy was garbage. I can't believe I had to watch that." But Judd is very, very good at going like, let's go a little bit unexpected here and have a brief moment of enlightenment for my mother and have her say something helpful to my character.
But it's also critical, and just in terms of the arc of your character's story, is that you need to be called into the extraordinary. You can't be...
Absolutely.
You can't just do what you were doing if you want to succeed.
And that's what happens with conversations like Rick. And that's why... And by the way, when it's happening, when Rick is telling me you're just another comic, my heart is breaking. Mm-hmm. That's a point of Crashing, and that's a point of my book, is that suffering, a divorce, a loss of faith, someone telling you that you're white bread and that you're just like a bad comedian... Obviously, we don't say these things in the moment. If someone is suffering or if someone listening is suffering, you don't go like, "Don't worry, suffering's grace." But in my experience, looking back every step of the way, and I don't mean things work out for a reason, like, yeah, but then I got an HBO show. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about inner transformation and these really difficult things. I have an external manifestation that represents my inner transformation, which is some success, right? And that's more American. Like, but Pete got told off by that manager, but who's laughing now? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying what he was saying to me caused a chain of events internally in my emotional and my psychological, and I would say my spiritual world was shifted and grew because of suffering, because of my wife leaving me, because of someone saying you're a snooze on stage. All of these things that you wouldn't ask for. Richard Rohr, this Franciscan friar who I'm obsessed with, he's like, you won't change without suffering. Why would you? If it's working, if what you're doing is working, look at the human animal. You'll never change. If what I was doing, like sort of like asinine, bad Seinfeld, was working, I'd still be doing that. But luckily, somebody came in and really kicked me in the stomach.
Well, because the interesting thing is, I think, let's say, you know, there's you know, comedy has many outlets, right? So there's the stand-up comedy in a club. There's where many people probably don't know you. They're just in the club. They're tourists, whatever. Then there's stand-up comedy where everybody in the audience knows you. They bought tickets to see you, and you're going to do an hour. And then there's doing things
like— We call
that
the difference between the road and touring.
Okay.
Isn't that a funny turn of phrase? John Mulaney doesn't go on the road. John Mulaney tours.
That's it.
You know
that's
what I mean? Like, right, he's like, it's good to see you still get out on the road. No, we don't. The road is going to the Comedy Cafe in Milwaukee and being the middle. That's the road.
Right, because the tour—
And that's something to be proud of if you're doing that. That's like fucking difficult shit.
So, and then there's also the next, you know, in, not necessarily the next steps, but then there's like talk shows, sitcoms. There's all sorts of outlets for comedy. But the kind of asinine Seinfeld observational stuff.
Seinfeld?
That stuff will work in a club forever, is the thing.
Right.
And so you have to kind of also be pushing yourself to do the next level of your career and understanding what that is.
Well,
so
yeah.
What drove you there? Because I see a lot of club comics after 20 years are still doing clubs.
Right. I think that's a New York specific stereotype almost. Mm-hmm. The guy with the 15 that kills, and you do it for 20 years so you can get drunk or get stoned or get laid.
Yeah,
and so that's really sad. It is like the hero's journey. It's like there are sirens that call you to the rocks, and one of them that's very seductive is like, just find a really good 15 and work the clubs and just and kill every set. So that's what, avoiding suffering, and then you can smoke weed afterwards. What's that? Avoiding suffering.
Yeah.
And to me, when my wife left me, not to get too heady about it, I realized that comedy, and this isn't in the book because it's a little too up my own ass, but like comedy is noble. People are hurting and it's good. It's good. It's like a good thing to do. And when you're hurting and when you need a laugh, it really brought out that almost essential quality to stand up. And then like, okay, so you have these people's attention. Think about an audience. Don't do it before you go out on stage. It's good to think of them as one thing before you go out on stage. But if you afterwards think about the individuals, the heartbreaks that are in the audience, some of them are being cheated on. Some of them just got sober. You know what I mean? Some of them, they just lost a parent.
Too bad there's a two-drink minimum in most clubs. They just got sober.
Two-item. It's a two-item minimum here at Stand Up New York. And you really are, and I don't use this in a religious way, you're ministering to them. You're ministering in the way that someone bringing chicken soup is ministering to a sick person. So you can really relieve that tension. So what are you going to do with it? Are you going to talk about piddly shit? Or are you going to go deep? Like, how deep are you going to cut as a surgeon? You can just go like, most stand-up that I see, and I love to say this again to my people, is like most stand-up I see is just reaffirming what the crowd already knows. I fucking can't stand it. I can't. I'm sounding righteous, and I do it sometimes, but I can't stand it. People just go, isn't sex great? Isn't eating great? Aren't movies great? Or they're just shitting on things that we all hate. Aren't others the worst? Aren't, you know, fucking in-laws, whatever it might be.
Right.
And they're just holding the mirror up, and they're just going like, leave the same. And something happens when you're in pain, you realize that you have an opportunity to like really rearrange the molecular structure of a lot of people in a positive way, where maybe, let's just say, the energy can flow in them a little bit more pleasantly beyond. I know I'm being a little bit high-hoped about stand-up, but good comedy can fucking change this. And make you go, and then the joy that might have gotten blocked and just stayed here and died, maybe it'll go all around here the next day. Because you saw somebody on stage that knows how to alchemize pain into pleasure. And I'm getting emotional, but that's fucking beautiful.
So let's break that down. So you could say something that everybody agrees, but you could say it in a clever way so that they laugh. Like, ugh, don't the subways in New York suck? Here's why.
That's right.
Then, like, one level deeper, I think you could say something that they all know but don't admit.
For
instance, in your book, Comedy, Sex, God, you're very vulnerable about sexual troubles as you're, you know, first having experiences both with your wife and then after the divorce, yeah. and you're still trying to come to grips with your sexuality and religion and so on. So sexual difficulties is something everyone in the crowd has experienced, but it's not like they all have conversations about it.
I have a bit right now about losing my erection with my wife, and I go like, guys, fellas, clap if you lose your erection, because it's like the opposite of what they want. I think that's that. If you're on stage and not talking about losing your erection, shame on you. Fuck you. That's me and Mulaney joke that I want to put out an album with this fake comic persona that we made up, and the name of the record would be Always Hard, which I just think is like, that's what most comedy is doing, is like, I'm always hard. I'm always number one. I understand not all comics are that way. That's a rare anomaly.
Well, I think self-deprecation, though, is a tool of the comic.
And you see that a lot, too.
Yeah, but then there's another layer deeper, which is finding an observation that you say that then the audience realizes, oh, I've always been thinking that way. I just didn't realize it.
That's right.
So you have this one bit that I saw on one of your Conan sets where you missed yearning for knowledge.
Yeah.
So like Google, like now we just know everything. Like what's, I forgot the specific.
It's when Google was new.
Right.
Like back when we got Google on our phones and that was a new thing.
Right.
And I was starting to see, as we all were, it wasn't like I was Nostradamus, but I was just noticing that everybody was Googling everything now.
Right. So you would say, where's Tom Petty from? And now, if between the time that thought occurs and the time I know the answer, it would be like 3 seconds. And it used to be, you would ask all your friends. Yeah. No one would know. And you would be left with this yearning. Where's Tom Petty from? Then you see the girl with the Heartbreakers t-shirt.
Yeah.
And now, you know, Tampa.
You run up to her. You're so excited. Yeah.
And so that whole concept is funny. It makes me think, oh, yeah, there is this yearning that I'm for knowledge that I no longer have. But then you have a punchline, and then that's how you met your wife, or then you get married.
Right.
Like, because satisfying that yearning is almost like satisfying this, like, lustful desire.
That's right. Because it's the dehumanizing thing of phones. I think, again, I don't want to toot my own horn, but what I want to do is encourage comedians, because we have this platform, even if you're not doing it consciously, I think if you're filling your life with good thoughts and good ideas, reading good books, watching good films, documentaries, whatever, listening to good podcasts, if you put some good stuff in there, you don't have to consciously try to sit down and write a woke bit or like a bit that's going to have a unique perspective. If you're consuming unique perspectives, you're going to start outputting your unique perspectives.
So like, let's talk about that bit or a bit that you did two nights ago in the show that went well. Is it that you wrote down, you thought of something or you read something in a book and you're like, oh, here's an interesting perspective I haven't thought of, and you write something down, or do you work it out on stage? Like, what's the process?
It's a little of both. Mm-hmm. It really is like an outline. It'll be something that like I'm feeling strongly about.
And okay, give a specific example.
The losing erection thing is good. So the bit is basically, it's a new bit. It's about how I'm straight, but that doesn't mean that like I think men are gross, or specifically like dicks are gross. So what's funny is like, so what makes me soft
it's
about
men? It's a funny
men,
premise.
Yeah, I think so too. But you're already going at like, if you want to go up on stage, you caught me being proud of myself. No one's going up on stage, or not a lot of us are going up on stage. You're supposed to go up and say dicks are nasty. And my bit is I jerk off all the time and I'm not going, oh, gross, you know what I mean? I'm slow with myself, I work it, you know what I mean? Like I'm giving a dick a hand job. And I love it, it's like one of my favorite things to do. But like we're so hyper masculine and we're so afraid of vulnerability and we're so homophobic that people who are straight typically want to be like, dicks, blah. And I'm like, have you seen a pussy? Like, they're not so great either. Like, it's all just genitalia. Do you understand what I'm saying? Obviously, they're both beautiful in their own way. But, like, I said, nobody, like, I don't care how straight you are. The first time you saw a vagina, most of us were like, maybe some Super Nintendo first. You know what I mean? So then, so this goes to the losing the erection thing. I was like, okay, well, what is it then? What am I not attracted to? Why am I not gay? That's the unpacking. Why am I not gay? Right? So then I go, male energy. I hate male energy. And I say this to the crowd. I go, women, not all women, some women have a lot of male energy, for lack of better terms, but women in general tend to have more grace and flow and spaciousness. It's built into their physiology. They have flow. I'm not trying to be funny. They flow. I don't say this part on stage.
That's funny, though.
Yeah, it's true. But it's true. They tend to be a little bit more open, communicative. They listen more. They're that a lot of the times. Not always. But men, you know, I talk about men just dicks themselves. It's like the cigar of the body. It takes over the room, you know, fills with smoke. Men are just like we love taking up space. And then I bring up the idea about losing my erection with my wife. And then she says, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And then I get an erection because female energy turns me on. Like her going like, it's all being emotionally vulnerable with me. Turns me on. And well, I go, oh, I'm safe. And then we have good sex. But male energy is like when you ask someone to take a photo and they take 1,000 photos, just the same, you're just going like this. And they give you the phone back and there's 10,000 of the same photo. That's male energy. That's what makes me soft.
Well, this is an amazing podcast, by the way.
It's a new bit. I can feel that it's not like crushing, but like... that's my point is if I'm doing it, and even as I'm doing it, I'm nervous that you won't understand what I'm saying. Those are stakes. I'm walking this tightrope where I'm like, oh, I don't want them to think that I think vaginas are gross. I don't. And there's even a small part of where I'm like, I want to make sure I sound like I'm a virile guy or whatever it is. I'm here and I'm doing the bit and I get nervous and I do it in a way that I couldn't do it if I was just like, what's up with RoboCop?
But I think what's happening here is also where all of us thinking of tags for this bit now.
That's probably like, yeah, there's 15 comedians in the room.
There's a funny premise there and I've already got like 5 tags that I'm thinking of. But you bring up a good point and this happens in the book. You're the first time out after your divorce, you're having some difficulties in this manner. And
that's who I'm writing the bit for. The guy out there that's like, I say in the book that like, usually when people get left by their wives in a movie, the next scene is a montage of them having random sex. Not my experience.
Right, right. And that's kind of a funny statement on kind of the Hollywood thing and kind of the masculinity thing and our myth about it. But also, there's an important, there's kind of a connection to comedy or to any kind of success in anything. And sexual success is sort of the primal manifestation of it. High stakes leads to often worse performance. Mm. So if you're in love with someone, sometimes it's harder to get hard.
That's right?
If you're going up trying to audition for the Comedy Cellar or a show or whatever, you might not perform as well because your mind the stakes are higher. So how do you, after you know now, you know, doing comedy and having all these different successes in these high stakes situations, how do you for yourself
get comedy hard?
Get comedy, or get comedy not as high stakes so you get
I think that's a beautiful question. Something that I think all the time is that expectation is the enemy of comedy. So if you're like, I'm supposed to do well, or I'm supposed to kill, or it's my late night debut. It's also a spiritual idea. You start telling yourself a story, and it's often a story that causes suffering, not actually what's happening. So what is a much more spacious and liberating space than what you think it is and what you think it's supposed to be. And I'm not trying to force the spiritual thing. I was saying in another interview, and I got it from Eckhart Tolle. He talks about like if a flight is delayed, that's just happening. And you have a choice to say yes to what is happening and just sort of melt into it and merge with it. You can honor your anger and your frustration. But really, if you look and if you're in the witness, you'll notice that it's the story that causes the suffering. You go, the ticket costs this much. United did this last time. You know, they're a bunch of don't say that word. So you get... The story makes you angry. Similarly, in comedy, you being present to what is and not being attached to the story of how it's supposed to be, I've done Conan and the Crowd is fucking garbage. And you're like, this is my late night debut. They don't know. It's a different story for them. This is, they had nothing to do in Burbank. You know what I mean? And that's okay. So surrendering and merging with what is and not resisting what is a wonderful thing to do. So when I'm doing comedy, like something that I try to remind myself is I go, it's not about the words. It's never about the words. Gerard Carmichael and I were talking about this on my podcast. He says, it's a shared nowness with the audience. So when I'm doing comedy, I love to establish up top some way that I'm really there. You know what I mean? And a lot of comics do this.
What do you mean that you're really...
We do it naturally. You mention something funny about your intro, or you notice that somebody's feet are on the stage, or whatever it is. Just something to prove I'm also here.
I don't think I understand so much. So you're saying you're on the stage, they're in the audience. Are you trying to say, point out something that suggests...
Something organic, an improv, a riff.
So that it doesn't feel to the audience like an act.
That's right. It doesn't have to be a riff, by the way. It can be a beat that you take before you start. You'd be surprised. I can get a pretty good laugh, especially if I'm doing a showcase show, just with a beat of silence up top, where you just survey them, take them in a comfortable way, and just go like, yeah, I'm here too. And this has never happened. This assembly of audience and me on this day, it's never happened. And you sort of like quietly respect that, and then you start. It's a powerful thing.
It reminds me actually of one of your co-stars on a couple episodes on Crashing, TJ Miller. Often when I see him do stand-up, particularly in different clubs, it's sort of like subtle, but the first thing I see him do, and it took me a while to notice this, is that he just looks around the room, yeah, and he tries to find immediately, something, like within seconds, some ridiculous thing.
He did,
like,
it on Crashing. He goes, the gristly pear.
Yeah,
remember?
Yeah.
He makes fun of the word gristly.
So I saw him at one place downtown that was like some old Wall Street bank that turned into a club. And he's like, are we in a 1970s disco? Because there was disco balls hanging from the ceiling. But he's like, right away, he's like looking for the one ridiculous thing.
So I don't think TJ would say it this way, but he's proving that he's there. Hmm. And you can do it with a moment, or you could do it with a riff. And because we were starting Chicago with TJ at the same time, a lot of us learned how to riff. If you watch me and Kumail riffing, you'll see that we learned a lot from TJ. Hmm. And something, a powerful thing in crowd work is, I love that. Is you just go, I love that this guy is leaning, you know what I mean? It's just something a little bit disarming. It's a wink to say, whatever I say, even if I'm rough with you, it's from this positive place. I love that this asshole, even just, I love that this asshole. No, I'm just, you know. I love, a classic one would be, I love this asshole has his sunglasses on. But at least you're giving it that, like, I love kind of thing. This asshole has his sunglasses on is different from, I love that this asshole has his sunglasses on.
That's interesting.
It's something we learned from TJ.
So, because I think a lot of the audience is very afraid to be called on, right? That's what they view it as. It's like they're being called on by the teacher in class when the comedian
comes
out.
And that's where hecklers come from. They're actually very scared a lot of the time. And then if you can demonstrate, it's like dealing with a barnyard animal. If you can demonstrate that you're calm and that you don't need... So many hecklers are made by the comedian. You know what I mean? Even if the initial moment is literally, you suck, that's just a spark. But then the comedian pours the gas on it or provides the kindling.
Like, what would you say if someone yelled out, oh, you suck?
I'd say, what's going on? What's going on in your day? You know what I mean? I know that sounds stupid.
That's funny because let me tell you about my day. I have this memory. This guy calls out, you suck to me, and that really felt bad.
Yeah, of course it did. You know what I might do too? That's another good choice. Here's the true answer. I would be honest. And there's different Pete's. We all wake up with a Rubik's Cube of who we are. There's all these different, you know, so I don't know which one. And there's Alpha Pete, and Alpha Pete would say, suck my dick. I was doing a show, and I know, you don't want to hear this face say that. But sometimes that happens. I was doing my special taping, and I was wearing the shirt that I was going to wear for the taping, and I said to the crowd, I was like, this is the shirt I'm going to wear. And somebody was like, boo, no good, or something like that. And the night before my special taping, and I just was like, fuck you. You're going to get in my head? I just told you, like, that sucked. I didn't wear it.
But maybe
that person was helpful.
But see, so everybody here just laughed at that, right? So often content like that, like hecklers could provide future bits.
That is true.
The story of a heckler is a bit.
That is true. Often it is true. But I do think, like, you suck is a hard one to come back from. But I've seen this happen a million times, and I can't get the word out enough to comedians, is someone will say something. You're just like, I went to 7-Eleven, and the guy goes, 7-Eleven sucks. But all the comedian hears is sucks, and like, and he or she then turns that person into a heckler. Oh, we got a smart ass. You got something to say? I've seen that happen a million times because you're in a position where you can hear them better than the person on stage. And then next thing you know, that person, scared, is saying you suck because they think that's what they're supposed to do. We're back to Lost. You've given them the role of other. Huh. They wanted to be audience, and audience wanted to be show. We wanted unity. That's what makes a heckler so offensive.
So I wanna get back to that. That sense of you want them not to be the other. But what are other ways? I'm getting back now to the original question, which is, what are other ways you reduce the stakes? You know.
Oh right. I didn't answer that question.
No, but you did a little bit, which is to say, put yourself there with them,
and also just enjoy it for what it is. Don't tell a story about what it should be. As comedians, we do this all the time. I have a show on Saturday, and it's outside, and I'm already dreading it. I'm just like, that's not good. I can't.
Outdoors?
It's an outdoor, I believe it's on a beach. And I'm just like, it's not gonna work.
Let me ask you a question. Why did you say yes to it?
What do you think?
I could say maybe you said yes to it because you wanted the challenge and you thought that would improve
that
you.
That would have been awesome, I wish. No, it was a well-paying opportunity.
Okay.
I know. But that happens. Sometimes you say yes to a hell gig because you're like, well, that seems worth it.
And then
when you're doing it, the game doesn't become about killing or not killing. The game becomes a game of chicken of like, I'm not going to sweat. It's a corporate show. So like corporate shows, I play a game, and this is helpful. This is one of the ways I think it's helpful, is you don't go for laughs. You go for, you can't make me sweat.
That's
so you stand there and you go like.
Because
you know you're going to do poorly.
At a corporate gig, you'll always do poorly?
Not all. No, but it's not going to be as good as a theater. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
So you're going to go down a few clicks just because it's outdoors or people are eating. That's what they said. They were like, it's going to be outdoors on the beach and people are eating. And I was like, okay. Different game.
Right.
So you do Conan, make a different game of it. You're not going to kill. Can you get that first line? Can you own the first moment? That's a fun micro game to play.
How do you try to own the first moment? Other than the idea of placing yourself with the audience.
To me, a lot of people, when they do late night, you can feel their nerves. So if you go out, so the game becomes then, can I go out and demonstrate that I'm comfortable, which is what we already sort of said. Can you give them a smile or like a hello? Just like that's what I would do.
And I like the advice you also gave where you wave hi to Conan on the way.
John Mulaney
gave you that tip to wave hi.
Birbiglia.
Oh, Birbiglia.
Yeah. Wave to the band. Uh-huh. Yeah. So if this is just practical, is like when you do late night, don't think about your whole set. Think about the first joke. That's very helpful. Because you're standing at a curtain with two union guys that are about to open it, like bulky guys. And I'll still catch myself, even if I'm doing panel. You're like, well, what are the five topics? Just think of the first topic.
So let's say you go out there. That first joke is high stakes, right? Because that's going to set the tone of the audience.
I'm glad you
brought
that up, because your first joke isn't going to do. That's what I tell everybody that's doing late night. I go, your first joke isn't going to work. And then the game is, so what the micro game then, like doing a potentially not as good as a theater corporate show. Let's see, it could be great. I'll text you. But the game becomes, can you do the first joke, not get a great laugh, not get the laugh that you're used to in a club, Because they're still getting used to you. You're this like foreign entity. Something else has been hosting the show this whole time. And then you come out and stand where they were standing and try to command the audience. It's a very jarring thing. So what I tell people to do any late night show is have a one-liner that you just sort of let not do well. Mm. It's like a sacrificial lamb. I did it in that Conan. I think I said like, the phone book arrived. It's like, here, we printed a portion of the internet for you to throw away. And it was fine. This audience right now is actually very similar. You're doing great, but I mean, like, it's not going to crush. You know what I mean? It's going to be like, joke acknowledged. And then start.
Then you have permission to kind of...
Take that moment to be like, I'm okay. I'm not afraid that joke did only okay.
Because also, I guess, if you go immediately into kind of deeper stuff that you care about, the audience hasn't yet acknowledged that they know you. So you have to kind of like introduce yourself. You can't just say, hey, I'm this, I grew up here.
That's
you introduce yourself with that first line.
That's right.
And it's just like, okay, like you just said the crowd did here, they acknowledge that you're up there doing comedy.
Right.
We're in the audience. Now go.
Well, we want them to have compassion for us, you know, to understand that we're doing something difficult. But we can, one of the great ways to manufacture that is to demonstrate it to them and be like, I understand, I just got here. You know what I mean? Like, this is weird.
It's like Louis C.K. directly addresses this thing when he has a bit where he says, there's no reason for me to be talking to you now.
I love that bit.
You're a bunch of strangers who are facing forward.
There's no good way to start stand-up. I saw him working that bit out, and he did it in Boston, and I was there, and he goes, there's no good way to start. And I was like, that is the best way to start, is to admit there's no good way to start.
Do you ever feel like, you know, like you have a bunch of comedians like that and a few others where they've kind of hit every single topic you could possibly think about? It almost seems like now no one could ever start their Conan set the way Louis C.K. just did, even though that's the perfect way to start.
I know it is, but there's gradations and different ways to acknowledge what's going on. I have a bit that predates that bit, actually, where it's like, I'll be riffing, and then you start doing a bit that's clearly a bit, and I'll stop, and I'll be like, I know it feels like I'm breaking into your bedroom right now. Like, it just feel, and then you do the joke again, you're like, so I'm from Boston, and you, like, climb through a window. It feels like you're trying to get away with something, right? So there are different ways to express the same feeling. What we're talking about is honesty. The best way to start is honestly. Like, I think a great way, it's difficult. You need to have good bits to follow through with, but a nice way to start is like, this is a really big deal for me, and then you pause and then just be like, you guys don't care. Like, that's a funny joke. Like, that's a nice bit to acknowledge the reality of what's happening.
I like, so the late Brody Stevens has something where...
Yes!
Yeah, it's exactly. That's a good. So he has something where if something doesn't work, and he often bombs, it's like half his YouTube videos are him bombing, but he's best at bomb. And he'll stop and say, okay, rewind, and he'll go to the beginning of the joke and just tell it in a different way.
Yeah.
And I like how he addresses it.
Dane Cook did that on his first record too, where it's actually a great example. It's on Harmful If Swallowed. He does this joke. The audience is still, they're nervous. It's the record taping show. So they're tense. He does the first bit. It does okay. He calls out that it's his record taping, that the joke only did okay, and he does the bit again. And that becomes, that. Not every comedian, by the way, I don't want Stephen Wright to start doing this. I don't want everybody to do the same thing. I'm saying one of the choices is to be transparent. But I'll give you an example of when it didn't work. I was in Peoria with Bill Burr 10 years ago, and I was middling, and I was bombing. And after like a couple shows, I think I just asked him what I should do. I was just like, first of all, I'm so sorry.
don't worry about it. Dun.
That's what he said. And I was like, what should I do? And he just goes, say, well, that sucked. Well, that sucked. Which is what Bill should do. And it's true. But what he was saying was, be honest. And if you're bombing, call it out. Comedy is about calling it out. You know what I mean? It's not about ignoring the thing. That's why if someone drops something or something happens, always abandon the bit and go to the thing. It doesn't matter if it was your closer. One time I hawked a loogie on my hand and I just acted like that didn't happen and just kept doing the bit because I was making a tape. But you know what I mean? Like, so, but then the next
set. Addressing what the audience is thinking is what you're
saying. Right, exactly. But then I was bombing the next set and I went, well, that sucked, but that's not my voice. You know what I mean? Like, what I wish I had done was taken his advice and the spirit of his advice. And if I was bombing and went like, ah, God, I really wanted you guys to like that one. I thought I had you. I really did. And here's the other problem, though, and this is really to express some solidarity. There's no foolproof system, obviously. Even if I had done that, I was too new. I didn't have any bits to follow it up with. Mm. That's what I really noticed. If I went, well, that sucked, even though it was like my favorite bit, the next bit isn't as good. If you didn't like that, you're really going to not like this one. So I realized, Bill can go, that sucked, and then start like an epic bit. I didn't have any epic bits. So I just want to express a little bit of reality here. Like, there's no technique that's going to save you from not having better material.
So we're going to, I know you have a time constraint. We're going to have to wrap in a second. But there's one thing I've been wanting to ask since I've seen this scene on Crashing. So I forget which season it was, but you're talking to Whitney Cummings. You're asking her for advice. And you're still in the young and up and coming phase, and she says there's no advice. And you say, please, you must have some advice. And she said, okay, the star is the person everyone wants to be friends with. And I was curious, what do you think that meant?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't write that. Judah Miller wrote that line. He wrote that episode. And we riff a lot, so there was a chance that it was just something Whitney said. But I know that Judah wrote that line. He said, a star is just somebody that everybody wants to be friends with.
That feels true.
I think there is some truth to that, but I'm not sure if everybody... We mentioned Louis. I don't know if everybody wants to... Certainly not now, but I mean, not every comedian is an example of the buddy comedian. When I interview somebody on my podcast, it is... an unspoken intention that I want to be friends with them. I'm like, I want, when this is done, not in a phony showbiz way, some of my greatest friends have come from my podcast. So I'm going for like, I want to bond so hard and get so deep and true and honest and loving with you that we're friends, right? Not everybody's that way. And not every star is that way. You know what I mean? I think there are, what we were going for, at least in part with that line was, no one wants to be Pete's friend. And I'd rather speak to that because there are a lot of comedians here and some listening. This is going to sound cocky, but it's for a loving reason. I was at the Boston, which was on West 3rd, and it was just a shithole. And I was handing out flyers, and we were holding our gloves up to the space heater so much that my gloves were melting. You know, you're just so cold and miserable. And you're not that great. You know, you're not that great. And I remember this woman was there, and she was just kind of like a staple of the neighborhood or something. And she was talking about how she used to come there when Chappelle would drop by. And Chappelle was 16. And she was like, and you just knew. You just knew. And I swear to God, and I say this, you can keep these things to yourself, as I did. I'm not saying you have this attitude outwardly. But it's okay to believe in yourself. I was like, fuck you, bullshit. Because I'm right here, and you don't know? Fucking hindsight. Eat a bag of shit. And everyone loves calling it. I knew. I was like, there's a great comic right next to you. And I want everybody to believe that. And I felt like people didn't want to be my friend. That's what the whole show is about. People don't want you at the table. People don't want you stealing the spot in the lineup. There's all this animosity and ugliness. And you need to go like, I think I'm living up to my own standards. I'm making the art that I want to see. When I'm on stage, and this was true back then, believe it or not, even though it was kind of corny, I was doing what I wished I would see. I was doing, if I was in the audience, I would have been like, this guy. And that's what I say when I'm bombing now, by the way. If I'm bombing
this guy,
or if a joke doesn't work, I go, if I was in the audience, I'd be losing my shit. And that's just a nice way of saying, it might not be for you, but if I saw someone talking about a forgiveness boner, I'd stand up, like Showtime at the Apollo. I would stand up. That's how much I would love it. So I was doing what I wanted to do, and I, again, quietly, nobody likes a cocky person, but it's okay. In fact, I would say that you can't really get past that next hurdle unless you sort of believe you can inside. I had this moment where I was doing some college tour with, I think Mike Britt was there and some other great New York guys. And I was backstage and I had this feeling of like, I had never considered doing anything other than stand-up. And I was like, I could never be on a bus. We did this on Crashing. I was like, I could never see myself on a bus. I remember where I was standing when I thought that. And then the voice said, well, you never will. Not that it's about being on a bus, but it's really true in my experience. You have to see it first. And I'm not talking about The Secret or something metaphysical here. I'm saying my green lighting, my own dream, and acknowledging that it's not impolite to want to have a TV show or to be in a movie, to have a hit podcast or whatever it might be that's your ambition. It's okay to quietly, don't be an asshole, but to quietly go like, yes, that is okay. That's valid. It's not rude. It's not ugly. It's not impolite. And I'm not going to be rude, ugly, or impolite. But I am going to like quietly hold on to that little ember of hope. Because if you don't like fan that flame, I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here, it's going to go away. So I started from that day on. This is very chicken soup for the soul. But I did. I started picturing myself on a bus. Whenever I'd see a bus, I'd go like, I'm going to be on a bus. I'd just see my stupid face.
Have you ridden a bus since then?
What's that?
Have you gotten on a bus since then?
Yeah, the last couple times I was in New York, there were all these crashing buses. And I'm telling you, honest, the feeling wasn't, yeah. It was just like, wow, far out. That's really, it's humbling and amazing. And there was happiness for me without being on a bus. But there was openness for me in believing that that was one of the possibilities. I wouldn't be on this podcast going like, and I never was on a bus if I wasn't on a bus. It's not about being on a bus, but it is about a frequency you can maintain inside yourself. And that's a lot of what the book is about, is your inner reality.
Well, the book I enjoyed so much, it's called Comedy, Sex, God. How do you want to say it? Is it
No, you're
three
doing
things?
It great.
Comedy,
if you say
sex,
comedy, sex, God,
God,
it sounds like I'm a comedy, sex, God.
Right, that's...
But that's why the font is different.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So it's why Pete Holmes...
Each one gets its own font.
And I encourage people to, wherever they get their HBO, watch Crashing, go back, watch the Pete Holmes show, watch your YouTube clips, You Made It Weird, your podcast. Everything's great. I'm so grateful you came on the show.
Thank you, James.
If you're ever back in New York, I hope you come on again, and we'll continue the conversation.
That's great. Do you live here?
Basically.
Thanks, everybody.